Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It's Monday, 31st of August, 2020. And we are in we talked about it last week, sort of a melt up, a bubble where, the status is hard to determine in terms of timing, but we've had various looks at how the acceleration looks a bit destabilizing at some point at these episodes of accelerating price action when you're already in a very strong uptrend. Some sort of put you on a countdown at some point to a larger correction. So on slide one, I chose today to put up an S&P 500 chart just to point out, if you look back at 2019, you had quite a nice run of it into the end of that year. This is when the Fed, if we recall, of looking back, was turning around policy, was talking about expanding the balance sheet again, all pre the COVID crisis impacting markets. And this time around, just taking the trend line or the trend linear regression since the July lows, you can see that the steepness of this rally has been even more remarkable. And then this last little leg over, let's call it last 6-7 trading sessions, a further acceleration, even relative to that trend line. Peter, I don't know if you're seeing anything in the internals here, but I've just kind of remarked in the background, this is, it's getting off the rails a little bit in terms of price action, at least in terms of the trend.
Yeah, and as we talked about, I think there was a lot of anticipation going into that Federal Reserve symposium in Kansas about, could we get yield curve control? Because as we talked about, if we got yield curve control in the U.S., it would be a massive trade in growth stocks. But we didn't get the yield curve control. We got the average inflation targeting, and I think we're beginning to see a little bit of action and some liveliness in the longer end of the yield curve, which, not for now, is bad for equities. But if we've got the message right from the Fed that they will be allowing the long end of the yield curve to rise, and it seems like have a structurally weaker dollar, you should reduce your exposure to dollar assets over time from now on, and you should diversify your portfolios. You should probably also get some more gold. I'll let you talk about that later, Ole. So I think the speculative fever is still so strong in the U.S. We could probably still see the last push up, but I think we're getting closer to a very important inflection point where we'll see a lot of different trends that have been in play now for over half a year will change to something new. And I'll talk a little bit about that in terms of value stocks, but we'll take that in a few minutes. But you had a slide, John, as well.
Yeah, but also, treasuries. I mean, just to add to that, I mean, the election's coming up, the two very different outcomes there. And you have to if we recall, some of the revaluations and rallies we saw in the past was over Trump tax reform. If we see a Biden presidency and both houses of Congress, you're talking about a revaluation back the other way potentially, even if his first focus may not be on raising taxes. But just underlining the Treasury point there, really key stuff. We saw an interesting rise in yields late last week. We did not get that yield curve control message, which theoretically lets the long end of the curve continue to blow out if otherwise the outlook is strong enough economically for it to do so. And then we had the Abe news, I think caused quite a bit of back and forth in treasuries as well as late last week. So we're sort of holding our breaths here. I put in the ultras this year. This is the future on slide two that is linked to the longest 30-year T-bond. We traded that line you see there is around the 1.5%. So these quarter percent levels to me quite interesting. 1.5% is sort of the battleground now. And that prior big sell-off you saw back in early June, that was 1.75%. So watching those levels, and then on the 10-year, watching the 75 basis point, and then the big rise in yields back in early June, there is around 100 basis points just below. So I would underline that this, to me, especially given the crazy back and forth we had late last week around Fed Powell, et cetera, this is a key market where I'm getting signals from this week. If it goes back into the range, then it becomes a non-factor. But if yields continue to rise, it really starts to turn up the temperature on markets. And not least among those, it has to be gold, which is often shown at times to be extremely yield fixated.
It has been indeed, but I also note this morning that once again that the real yields are moving deeper into negative territory. So they have actually dropped by around 6-7 basis points since last week, negative 1.05. So that does indicate that part of this yield rise is the break-even side of things. So inflationary expectations, and that's really what I think is becoming an increased focus in gold. And on slide eight today, I just put in a couple of headlines. We know that we saw that Barrick Gold was bought by Warren Buffett a few weeks ago, And then over the weekend,
not outright. He took a big stake in it.
He took a big stake, in of course, $500-600 million stake. But and then late last week, report over the weekend, $16 billion Ohio Police and Fire Pension Fund. It's not a big one, but they approved the 5% allocation for gold, basically saying they're looking for diversification and inflation hedge. So it seems like we are having a theme building right now that some of the major asset managers, if they are not already in gold, they are most certainly having some second thoughts about potentially having to apply some additional exposure. And that may be the next leg higher if that underlying demand continues to come in from real money buyers. So, but looking at the chart this morning, not really anything new. We are at the high end of the recent range. We got the, I'll say 2015 to the upside is really the level that needs to get taken out in order to create some excitement. And the downside, we got the trend line from the recent lows and together with the 1900 level. So we're still stuck in range, but it looks like some underlying drivers are still potentially coming to the support.
I don't know which of you put in this Warren Buffett making another bet on the commodity sector. Is this just a 90th birthday party present to himself? Or
no, it was not actually a birthday present to himself, but it happened to be that the news were disseminated on his birthday. But Berkshire Hathaway has actually been in stealth mode for 6 months. There was a lot of speculation repeatedly what were Berkshire Hathaway using their money. They were definitely not shooting elephants, as has been talked about previously. He couldn't find attractive mega acquisitions because of the valuation levels that we also have been talking about. But it came out now that he's actually acquired some pretty big stakes in 5 trading companies in Japan: Mitsubishi Corporation, Mitsui Company Unlimited, Sumitomo, and Itochu on Marubeni. And you can see that on slide 3. They haven't really been doing quite well over the past 5 years, except for Itochu.
So they're calling trading companies. What's the angle here for these companies?
They trade in and out of physical commodities. ONI has promised to look more deeply into it because it will probably reveal what part of the commodity sector he's really pursuing here. But what I think the main message, and I'll let you also give some color on this, Ole. I think the main message here from Buffett is that he bought that pretty big stake in Barrick Gold, almost 10%. He also, in July, from Dominion Energy, bought gas pipelines and gas storage facilities. And now he's also going into Japanese trading companies. And he could have bought trading companies all over the place. We have many attractive trading houses in Europe. There's also trading houses in Canada and the US. But he chose Japan. And I think that goes back to the argument about, I think he's reading into the Fed's policy as that you need to diversify out of dollars. You need to get slightly less exposure to dollar assets, and Japanese assets are extremely cheap relative to a lot of other assets. And these 5 companies in particular are actually quite strongly in cash generation, and they're not very easy to replicate. When you control the physical commodity market, I'll let you talk about that, Ole, but when you control that, you really control it.
Yeah, and I think it just adds to this the theme that we've seen building now since the low back in March. I definitely see it in the weekly cut reports, which highlights the speculative interest being expressed by hedge funds, large hedge funds in the futures market. And last week, the total net long reached the highest level since June 2018. We've seen quite a strong buying in, especially in the agricultural space now for the past 2 months. I put in on slide 9, just you can see some of the spike higher we've seen both in the corn on the left and soybeans on the right. And it's happening at a time of the year where market is not really expecting much volatility. As you can see on the small insert, the black line is the current net in the key crops. And it's actually a counter-seasonal move because at this time of year, the harvest is more or less given. They know what's in store. And for the past few years, the harvest has been huge. So the market's been under price pressure. Right now, we're seeing weather worries in the US. We're seeing Chinese demand, which continue to remain very strong. We've seen a record pace of buying in corn and soybeans for the coming season in recent weeks. So these are all underpinning the prices, and it's creating some increased interest for the sector as a whole. So it's most certainly one we should look out for. And if we're seeing these prices that would obviously add to the underlying inflationary pressure.
Yes.
Interesting stuff. And then underlying the dollar point of, on all of this, we have late last week, we saw that dollar yen move. Tended to see a lot of positive correlation in the crosses between the U.S. Dollar and the Japanese yen. And it's very interesting as well to see the dollar yen towards the low of the range when you have treasuries selling off. Normally, you expect if yields are rising that the yen is doing the absolute worst across currencies. We've got to see this sorting itself out. In some of the yen crosses, we've kind of seen a neutralization. We saw the Nikkei sort of back to where it came from just already within a session on Friday after that announcement. So, or overnight after that announcement. So let's see what the status is here on the dollar yen. But to me, the more important is the euro dollar for the broad dollar status. And we still need to punch through that high and close above it. And I would argue close above 120. And then the interesting thing there, as Ola helpfully put in the slide on slide 7, pointing out the currency positioning in the U.S. futures market is just one snapshot of a portion of the market. It's not the entire currency market, but it gives you an idea of consensus in many cases. The dollar position, actually, if you took out euro dollar, it's not that remarkable. I've been surprised, for example, that there's barely any long, speculative long in the Aussie versus the dollar, despite its new record high close for the, not record high close, its new high close for the cycle on Friday. It's almost all in euro dollar. And you can see that on slide 7. It's at a record long as of the snapshot taken last Tuesday at plus 212,000 contracts. Historically, when things get this stretched, you have a really hard time continuing to punch higher or lower, depending on which way the position is running. So it's just one of that thing in the background that's a bit irksome, I would say, for those looking for a significant extension in dollar weakness, at least in euro dollar, if positioning is any guide on that matter. And then briefly want to mention Aussie dollar here. You can see it on slide 6 or pull up an Aussie dollar chart, very significantly higher close on Friday, a bull above 73. We had a decent bounce back in iron ore futures overnight again. There was an article I tweeted out earlier on my Twitter feed at John J. Hardy talking about the incredible comeback in iron ore prices is really supercharging the mining sector in Australia, whereas the rest of the economy, which is the larger portion of the economy, is suffering in terms of services, et cetera, post-COVID problems, what have you. So a very interesting place for the RBA, which is meeting tonight. And already the last time around in late July was mentioning concerns on the currency front, saying that he would like the Governor Lowe saying that he would like the currency lower, but it's not overvalued. So I'm wondering at what level, and I do know there is a level out there where we start to see a more explicit sort of currency war type situation, competitive devaluation, whatever you want to call it. So just interesting to put that out there as to see A, if Lowe brings it up, B, how forcefully, and C, does the market care given the backdrop and the fact that the dollar is weaker. So, but clearing a new level there on the Aussie dollar. And then Peter, you've got...
No, we need one thing before we go to the Zoom. We missed slide 4. And we need we need that one because it goes back to the whole discussion about rates, gold, and the dollar, etc. And it's on slide 4. I have a ratio chart where it's the MSCI World Growth Index versus MSCI World Value Index. And as you can see here, this is only a 5-year snapshot. But if I took a 15-year snapshot, it would have been almost an exponential move for growth stocks over value stocks. And it's this whole trend with constantly lower inflation and investors buying high duration assets versus these value stocks. And the big question is that if we get inflation, which is the most important question of our time, then it will, I think, finally be the turning point for value stocks and where value investors will come back laughing big time, because it will be a disaster for growth stocks. So I think it's important now to begin having a look at the value stocks and value indices and how they're responding to this, not a new world, but constantly when we get new inflation measures figures in, how these value stocks are behaving. Because I think value stocks is also the energy sector. It's also the commodity sector that Buffett is looking at. They have extremely low valuation. I think it's historically low valuation, both in absolute terms, but also in relative terms to growth stocks. So I think that potentially could be a monster trade, a decade opportunity here in value stocks.
If inflation is coming, and if you look back at the late 70s timeframe, you had a stock market that inflation adjusted was not doing fairly well. I think if you adjusted for dividends, it was doing a lot better than the averages showed you. But I'm just pulling a figure out of my hat here. But I think the energy component at some point back then was on the order of 25 to 26%.
Yeah.
And we're talking about, what was it, to hit 2% or something like that recently. It just, I mean, staggering. Staggering levels. This is a sector that's starved for capital at all, and in all cycles, and needs that capital if it's going to even maintain production. So unless we see a very, very rapid turnover to miraculous alternative energy sources, there's something wrong here, to my mind.
But then there's the whole discussion about inflation, right? I've seen Bank of America put out this chart over the past week or so with where they try to map demographics against inflation. And there's definitely some signs that demographics are determining inflation longer term. So, and then the demographic picture in the US, you and I have been talking about that a lot, John, lately. And in the US, we have dipped below two in terms of fertility rate. So there's a lot of signs, maybe long-term pressures on the US.
Yeah, correlation is not always causation, but
I agree.
But it's a pretty compelling chart.
It is. I also question the statistics.
And basically saying that's anti-inflationary.
Yeah, and on top of the demographics, which is a slowdown in population growth, you also have the continuous automation of manufacturing sector, which makes manufacturing much more unbounded and less constrained when you don't have humans to deal with in terms of working over hours and wages and all that. But you were talking before, John, about Zoom Video Communications, which is the company that really rose to prominence in Q1 on the backdrop of global lockdowns around the world. We also use Zoom right now for this podcast, by the way. And as you can see on slide 10, it has been a phenomenal ride in their share price. It just hit 300 last week, an all-time high, also on the closing on Friday. They're reporting Q2 earnings after the close. Revenue was up 169% year-over-year in Q1. Analyst estimates are expecting revenue to be up 250% year-over-year in Q2. So actually an acceleration there to $500 million in revenue. Regardless of that, it is still the most overpriced, the most rich in valuation in terms of enterprise value to sales in the entire U.S. stock market. So there will be immense focus, I think, on Zoom Video. They really have a high bar to get above, and the big giants
all scrambling. Is it priced though? Is it priced for somebody to take them over at some overvalued EBITDA that can afford that kind of overpriced value, or is it priced because they really think the organic growth potential is out
there? I think actually we're getting to a point where that's probably the only rational explanation for the valuation that people.
Because if you recall back in the day, it was a Facebook acquiring WhatsApp for some ungodly multiple because they know they need it as part of their monopoly platform. So.
Yeah, and Microsoft is actually doing quite well in this space, whereas probably it could be Facebook or Google actually. They just said, okay, we need to get fast into this technology. My final point today, and we have to talk about that because the Chinese economy is the second largest. Their banking sector is one of the largest in the world. All the four major banks reported earnings last week. I just compiled the numbers this morning, and I've showed this before. It shows you market cap to total assets. It's a ratio that you normally see rise in a positive credit cycle. We always see that in Europe and the US, and as it should be, because the market value of the cash flows from the asset base should go up in a positive environment, and it goes down in a bad environment. As you can see in China, this ratio continues to go down and down and down. And I think it just shows you the two things. It's Chinese banks, the private sector here, trapped in a vicious cycle of bad debt. They are being forced by the government to constantly expand and just provide loan and credits regardless of risk measures. So I think this chart also shows you the ever increasing involvement of the Chinese government into private credit. And with that, we know that when you put aside risk and it's driven by politics, I think it's pretty given that it will always lead to some horrible investments and bad debt coming. And as I said repeatedly, people have tended to forget that in the 1990s, the Chinese banking system completely collapsed and had to be rescued by the Chinese government. It could happen again. Big difference this time around is just that the Chinese banking system is just so much larger. So I don't think it's an imminent risk. It's just something you need to have in mind that there is a lot of fragility around Chinese banks and the financial system.
Okay, let's take it. We've got a busy calendar this week. We'll take you through it one day at a time every day. But I think the key today are two things. The Fed Vice Chair Clarida is out speaking today on monetary policy. Effectively, I don't have the title of the speech handy, but it's effectively the same, covering the same territory that Powell did in terms of the review of monetary policy framework. So watch out for that. Clarida is considered quite influential in terms of setting the tone on Fed policy. And that could move markets if there's a bit more details forthcoming, especially in terms of yield curve control or other hints that are a surprise relative to what Powell said. And then that RBA meeting and whether they flag the currency more significantly and whether the market reacts to that. But it leads us into the Asian session tonight, into this latest round of manufacturing PMIs. We have South Korea out, an interesting one there, especially linked into China activity. But of course, the rest of the world as well up tomorrow. And then as we head into Friday, we get the latest U.S. monthly job numbers, unemployment rate, etc. And we'll be watching the polls closely this week as Trump seems to be aligning himself very much in terms of divisive, pointing out, aligning himself on cultural war themes, I would argue, law and order, etc. It appears to be working to a degree. I think we won't really know the status of this for a while, but as we get into the end of the month and those debates start up, that's still quite a ways off. Unbelievably, as we are within almost within 2 months to the election now. For now, we'll call it a day, and we'll be back tomorrow with the Saxo Market Call. Thanks for joining.